Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Welcome to the 31st episode of Why Are People Into That? The podcast that doesn't have very good self-control. I'm your host, Tina Horn, and my guest this month is Ariel Greenberg, who taught me all about fetishistic indulgence. And where better to indulge than at smittenkittenonline.com? Sex toy retailer extraordinaire Smitten Kitten is the exclusive sponsor of this podcast. They continue to offer a special discount to Why Are People Into That listeners. Visit smittenkittenonline.com and enter the code Y, that's W-H-Y, during checkout to get 20% off your order. As some of you know, I've been toiling behind the scenes of the new sexuality-themed publishing imprint, 3L Media. We're finally starting to put out books. Genderqueer boundary breaker Jiz Lee has put together an unbelievable anthology called Coming Out Like a Porn Star, featuring Why Are People Into That guests Connor Habib, Ignacio Rivera, and James Darling, in addition to 50 other porn stars and behind-the-scenes porn makers. And remember the episode Why Are People Into Hair with Nikki Silver? Well, Silver has a photo book of naked hairy models cavorting in the sunshine, and the book is called Unshaven. I contributed a critical essay about feminism, body image, and California punk life to this book. Oh, and 3L also put out my nonfiction book about Bay Area escorts, pornographers, and fetishists. Love not given lightly. Don't forget, my next book, Sexting, is out in January, and if you want to review it or interview me, hit me up for an advanced copy. My God, that's a lot of books. I hope you caught all that. So, stay in bed. Pour yourself another glass of single malt scotch. Eat the whole pizza. And have another orgasm while you indulge in Why Are People Into Hedonism.
Hello, Ariel Greenberg.
Hello, Tina Horn.
It's so nice to be here in this luxurious W Hotel room. I have to tell you, for two reasons, I got such nice, nostalgic poker vibes. First of all, the first dungeon that I worked out of in New York City is around the corner.
Cool.
And I came out of the subway and I just completely had that moment of being like, the old fantasy commute. And then also like coming into this extravagant hotel and getting in the elevator and the fancy things and like not knowing you and meeting you in the lounge, I was like, oh, this is nice. This will probably always feel like this. Yeah. But we're not here for a session. We're here to talk about
it. Unfortunately. Well, let me tell you, Tina, actually, no. Yeah, the Hotwire, dude. I mean, get good deals in that Hotwire.
Oh, yeah. Are they paying you? Great. So first of all, you are a poet. and a professor. We met because you asked me to write for your series on the Rumpus.net, great literary magazine founded by Stephen Elliott, who was a guest on this podcast talking about submission. And your series is called Kink, Writing While Deviant.
Yes.
And there's two out right now, Janet Hardy, and what is the other gentleman's
name? Michael Broder.
Right, that one about being a pig is just really, really good. And Janet Hardy's is kind of about being a switch, right?
Exactly, yeah.
My piece is going to be out on there soon. And tell me a little bit about the series and why you wanted to do that particular series.
Sure. So like you and like your amazing podcast, I mean, I just have a lifelong interest in why people are into the things that they're into. More and more I'm exploring this in my own writing and sort of as part of my professional career. You know, it used to be the thing I did on the side is kind of try to research the sexuality stuff, but more and more it's becoming what I'm writing about. And for the major conference in creative writing last year, I proposed a panel on kink and writing. But the idea of it wasn't that it was going to be about, you know, people who wrote erotica or people who wrote about kink. There's plenty of that out there. That's wonderful. But really more about how a writer's own kinky sexuality informs their writing practice, how those two things intersect and overlap. I thought that was pretty fascinating to think about. And so I proposed this panel and I put a call out there to see who would want to be on it. And I got so many people saying like, yeah, I'd talk about that. That's super cool. Which was amazing. You know, people came out of the woodwork to say, I would totally be on that panel. And then the panel didn't get accepted. I don't think, you know, that means anything. This particular conference has like thousands of, you know, panels submitted and very few get taken. But, because it didn't get taken, I thought, well, there's all these people now that I know who want to write about this. Yeah. I should see what I can do. So literally I sent an email to Stephen Elliott, who I kind of know a little bit through mutual friends, and I, you know, I know about him, and I know that he obviously runs a kink-friendly literary site. So I thought, yes, you know, what could be more perfect? And incredibly, sort of within the hour, they got back to me, and they're like, yeah, you can do that series. And I was kind of like, I mean, it helps that I'm a writer with a reputation, and, you know, that's great. But still, I was like, really? You're just going to let me do a series on that? And they're like, yeah. How often do you want to do it? When do you want to start?
Yeah, they're like, this is maybe just, like, a little bit part of our mission.
Right, exactly.
This is maybe the rumpustiest series you could have proposed.
So, I'm super grateful to the Rumpus for letting me do this. And so, I have about a year's worth of columns lined up already, about one a month. And so the idea here, again, and I feel like this is the hard thing to explain because I have gotten a lot of people writing to me and saying, oh, you know, I'm dominant, whatever, I'm really into handcuffs, I want to write you this erotica piece about handcuffs. And I'm like, no, this is about how your writing practice is like your kink practice in some way, or your writing mindset is like your kink mindset. So, you know, your piece is on irony and kind of uses of irony in BDSM and in literary writing. That's perfect. Like, Michael's piece was about how submitting and sort of surrendering as somebody who enjoys bareback cum dump sex is like kind of giving yourself over to the poetry muse.
Yeah, he's like, I'm a pig for poetry.
Yeah. Like, this is, it's so great.
Yeah, it also... coincidentally, like, it couldn't be more up my alley. I'm so excited, like, to read everybody's essay.
Yeah, it's really cool. And so, like, one of the ones I'm really excited about that's coming up is a person who does literary translation, wants to write about how disappearing into a translation, when she's working on a translation, is like disappearing into subspace as a rope bottom. How she kind of, like, dissolves. And I was like, yes. So that's the kind of thing that people are going to be writing about. I have a really wonderful mix of folks lined up. I will say, to listeners out there, funnily enough, like, the contributors I most need for this right now are cisgendered men, specifically, like, hetero-leaning cisgendered men. They are not coming out of the woodwork for whatever reason. So if you are a writer of any genre, nonfiction, poetry, fiction, erotica, self-help, journalism, playwriting, performance, whatever, some kind of literary writing, and you're interested in writing about how that's like your kink in some way, that would be, you know, everybody should please get in touch with me. But, you know, especially guys. Cis guys.
Don't you sort of feel like the history of Western literature is maybe slightly sublimated version of what you're talking about? Not like, yes. It would be nice to have somebody, like, have the nerve to talk about it more explicitly, but I do kind of feel like maybe they have other outlets for that, and that's why they're not coming to you.
In my intro to the series, I talk about D.H. Lawrence and James Joyce and Oscar Wilde, and I'm like, okay, these were guys who clearly, like, let their kink in, like, enter their writing, and would it have been amazing to get them to write about that, like, directly? They couldn't have ever had that conversation.
Right, exactly.
But so, yeah, I do think that the sublimated, repressed version is out there in the form of actual literature, but not the kind of transparent conversation of where you're just like, so this is what I'm into. This is why I have all those novels with, like, this mother figure in them, because I actually really think I have a mommy thing, or...
Yeah, we're like, millions of English students are like, we know. where should people contact you if they are interested in contributing to the series or learning more about it?
Kinkwriting@gmail.com is the email for the series. You can also find me all over the web at Arielle Greenberg, and you can, you know, message me on Facebook, or my email is findable through my website. But Kink Writing is the one specifically for this.
Cool. And it's therumpus.net.
It's therumpus.net. Yeah. And Kink Writing While Deviant, if you do a little search for that, you'll come up with the ones that are
cool
up so far.
And what's your URL for your website?
ArielleGreenberg.net.
Cool. So now that we've got that out of the way,
yeah,
let's get to the subject at hand. We talked about a lot of different possible subjects for today. It turns out you have a lot of very dirty things on your mind. But what we settled on is, why are people into hedonism? And I would love for you to talk about what that means to you.
Yes. So first of all, it doesn't mean the swinger resort, which called hedonism.
Oh,
sometimes when I say that, or if I even, like, you know, put it on a badge or something, I'm aware that that might read otherwise, which that's also cool. But and I'm particularly into other people's hedonism, which is, okay, like, even more complicated. But I would say that as a sexual identity, the idea of being a hedonist is that you get off on indulging your own sensual pleasures.
Mm.
So that can be in, you know, touch and sex itself, or in food, or in drink, or in kind of luxurious living in some way or another, basically kind of going a little over the top to give yourself pleasure in various ways.
Cool. So sort of a, like, bacchanal of the senses.
Yes.
Cool. So tell me about what you mean when you say that you're into other people's hedonism, maybe more than your own.
Yeah.
Or that your hedonism is other people's hedonism.
Right. Well, so I would say that for me, and I think there are other fetishes out there that are kind of like this, part of the idea behind it is that you don't let yourself do this.
Right.
You get to watch other people do this. So in that way, it's, like, a little bit similar maybe to, like, a cuckolding cuckweaning thing, where you're like, oh, I don't get to have that thing, but I get to watch my partner have that thing. Mm. And that's what's hot to me, is sort of the self-sacrifice and the other person's indulgence. So for me, like, very explicitly, I am not, and I think this is part of, like, the why for me, is I am somebody who's pretty, likes to be in control, who likes to be pretty moderate in what I do and responsible, and those are in my nature anyway, like, that comes easily to me, but also it really doesn't feel good to me to be out of control in those ways.
Interesting.
I don't enjoy that feeling. It makes me feel a little crazy, and not in a good way. So, but I think that's part of why other people, like, really letting themselves have what they want is so kind of exotic and erotic and enticing to me, because I'm like, wow, what would that be like? You know, I'm pretty strict with myself.
So you're voyeuring on other people's indulgence.
Voyeuring, but also more actively participating as an encourager.
Okay, or enabler.
Enabler, right. Right. So in the gaining community, which I would say my fetish has a lot of overlap with, although, you know, it's not quite the same thing, they're, you know, like the fetish is gainer slash encourager. You can either be on the receiving end as somebody who, you know, is eating and gaining weight, or you can be on the encourager end and you're somebody who helps somebody else gain and encourage. And there are definitely people on both sides of that slash, and the encouraging people get just as much out of it as the gaining people. Like, their fantasy world is huge around that. So I would say, yeah, like, I'm an encourager for all these different kinds of hedonism. And in you know, 12-step parlance, that would make me an enabler.
but it's consensual, yes. So it's not enabling or codependency.
Right, and it's, I would say that that's kind of the emotional edge play aspect of it that's really, like, interesting and hot to me, is that it like, comes right up to that line, right?
So it's dangerous.
It's genuinely dangerous. But also, I would say, like, you know, I'm responsible about it, so I would never encourage somebody to do something that is genuinely bad for their health. Or, like, if I felt like my partner really was having problems with addiction or alcoholism, we would get on that right away. Like, it's because I feel like I know that he actually has good boundaries around that stuff that I can play with. Like, oh, you should have another drink, you know? Yeah.
Oh my God, it's so interesting. So, part of what I feel like I'm hearing from you is that you're sort of playing with fire in this territory of understanding people's psychological desire to let go or lose control. And, you know, we all, to a certain degree, have to have our own boundaries with ourselves and our own amount of self-denial or self-control. But to have somebody else give you permission to push yourself, I can, so I'm imagining myself as, like, the person that you, or that somebody with your fetish, would be encouraging, and that because maybe it would be something that I don't feel comfortable giving myself permission to do for lots of psychological reasons that we could unpack, but if somebody else who I trust gives me that permission, then I can let loose and enjoy it more fully and completely, because it kind of turns off that voice in my head that says, this is bad, you shouldn't do this, you know, it's nurturing in a way.
And it's also sort of service submission in another way, because I'm like, you get to have the power of giving yourself these things. I'm encouraging you to step into that space, right, of power, where you get to give yourself these things that maybe you would worry about or feel guilty about otherwise.
Right. You're kind of relieving people of these horrible influences of guilt, shame.
Yes. And so I would say, in that way, one of the reasons I don't call myself, like, an encourager, like, in the gaining community necessarily, or, you know, consider myself, like, a feeder in that way, is because what I've seen, because I spend a lot of time in the outlets for those communities, because it is the most close overlap, so I can totally get off to that material. But a lot of that material is about forcing somebody to do something past the point that they want to, or past the point where it's pleasurable for them. Like, there's a lot of gaining porn that's about, like, oh, I feel really sick now, or, like, I really, you know, I really can't move, or, like, whatever it is, and they don't enjoy it.
Right.
And for me, like, the reason I would call it hedonism, the difference I would say there, like, the distinction there, is that hedonism is about someone's pleasure. Mm-hmm. So if somebody's, like, drunk to the point where they're feeling not well, like, that is not erotic for me at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's only when they're like, I feel really good, that I'm like, oh, yeah. that gets me really excited. So, and I would say, like, this, so this works for me with sex, too. So if somebody's like, oh, I really want to fuck that other person, and that would feel really good to me, I can also get off in that in the same way. And I think part of what all of these behaviors have in common is that they are socially taboo, like, right. genuinely risky in the world of saying, like, it's not okay for your partner to be like, oh, there goes somebody really hot. I want to fuck them. Not just you. I gotta want to go fuck them.
Right.
And to be like, yeah, you should do that, honey. Like, you should go fuck that other person. That would be fun for you. Or to say, like, I already had a donut. I kind of really want another donut. And for you to be like, yeah, you totally should have that other donut. So those are things in our culture that we are taught not to say to our partners for the most part, right?
Right.
So that's part of, I think, the taboo is certainly part of it for me.
Yeah, definitely. Oh my gosh, there's so much to unpack here. I love it. So so tell me, give me like another sort of porn or erotica scenario in which an enabler, or maybe we can come up with a better word than enabler or encourager, because it does sound like that's specifically attached to feeding and gaining community. Maybe what we need to do is like come up with a new name for it. How do you identify?
I identify first and foremost as a fetishist, because the other thing I would say, which we can talk about, is that like this has been in me since as long as I can remember. I was masturbating to orgasm to this stuff at 5.
So can you give me an example of a scenario that like now would be like a masturbatory fantasy that is a part of this fetish?
Sure. Well, I can talk about stuff from when I was a kid too. So like I think it's fascinating, and other fetishists also think it's fascinating, how much of this how much fetish material is in children's cartoons. And I never know if that's because, like, they are getting at our deepest kind of id stuff, right? Or, like, cartoonish, you know, extremes of behavior, and that is often what fetishists like. But, you know, rote people will tell you, like, oh my god, there's so many people being tied up in children's cartoons.
Like, to the train tracks and stuff. Yeah.
Totally. Or spanking. You know, there's spanking machines in Betty Boop cartoons and, like, all of these things.
Yes.
So, similarly, for me as a kid, Hansel and Gretel cartoons. So where the and I know that that's not quite it, right? Because she's like going to eat them at the end. But and there are people who are into that, but I'm not one of them. Where the kids are like, she's encouraging them to eat all this bad stuff,
right?
But they're also like, yeah. Like, we're kids, like, totally we'll eat, like, all the candy. And
well, she's
like,
trying to fatten them up,
she's trying to fatten them up, right. And, but there's something about the fact that they're not resisting, like, they're like, yeah, 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 I want that. That was really hot to me as a kid. The hottest scene for me, in some ways, I think, as a kid, was in the animated movie of Charlotte's Web. Templeton the Rat goes to the fair, and totally overdoes it. So he eats like all the garbage at the fair, and then he actually, so one of my big things, and again, one of the reasons I don't feel as strictly part of the gaining community, is because it's equally hot to me for someone to drink too much as it is for someone to eat a little too much.
Yeah.
And he like basically dives into a pitcher of beer that's left over and comes up stumbling and, like, visibly drunk, but totally enraptured. Like,
right.
He's proud. He's, like, his stomach is
distended. His stomach is distended.
He's drunk, and he's like, this is the best night ever, and I don't give a shit, right? And that, I was just like, oh, my God. Like, this is all my things. You know, as a kid, I mean, still to this day, it's an animated cartoon about a rat, and I can totally get off to that. and it's really just about the, like, I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want, and because it's going to feel really good to me, and I don't care, and at the end of the night, I'm going to be, like, proud as hell that I just did that. I'm not going to feel ashamed or guilty. He comes back to the other animals at the fair, and he's like, I had the best night, and they're like, you're disgusting, and he's like, I don't care.
Yeah. Yes, I am. Yeah. I'm fucking disgusting.
Yeah. And he doesn't even think of it that right. He doesn't even say I'm disgusting. He's like, no, I like did it up.
No, I'm the shit.
I'm the shit, right.
I found the party. Right. That none of you guys were having.
Right. Well, somebody did. That's the other thing that's hot about it, actually, is the goose, or whoever it is, tells him before he goes off. He doesn't know. He's like, I hate being at the fair. It's so boring. I don't want to, like, hang out with Wilbur anymore. And the goose or whoever is like, oh, you don't know. Like, when the fair closes at night, it's a rat's paradise. There's food and, like, things everywhere. And he's like, what? And they're like, yeah, dude, you should go check it out. And he's like, oh, my God. So there's also this moment of someone encouraging him and him getting excited about it, which is also really hot to me.
It's interesting to imagine also the role of that in that story. I can't remember if that actually happens in the E.B. White
book. I think there's a little scene of it, but this is a musical number.
Sure.
Also voiced by Paul Lynde.
Oh! So. Oh my God, I forgot that too. But, you know, I mean, the rest of the story is, in a way, not a morality tale, like a sanctimonious morality tale, but it is about integrity and self-sacrifice and...
It is, but I think it's also about animals being animals, which I would say is a huge part of my fetish.
Right.
So, like, you know, Charlotte dies because that's what spiders do. Like, Evie White isn't interested in telling a story about animals not acting like themselves.
Right.
Like, their natures.
So, even in the way that they're anthropomorphized, it's along the lines of what animals' personalities actually are.
Right. So, I mean, Wilbur's like, he's still a pig. Like, you know, we don't have to get so deep into Charlotte's Web, but I think that the idea that, like, yeah, you're a rat, and this is what rats like to do, so that's what he's gonna do is, you know, in the book, and definitely then kind of, like, writ large in the movie. Which is mostly gay men, though, of course. Right, in the gaining communities. Well, there's a lot of straight men who are encouragers of women.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the gaining community is most of the erotica is gay male.
That's interesting. I don't think I actually knew that.
Oh, yeah.
I sort of have an idea of gaining that... I would actually love to talk to more folks who are involved in the gaining community and are doing it ethically and consensually, because I am realizing that I totally have a prejudice of it in my head that probably comes from some, like, Dateline late-night thing about it, where, like, the image that I have in my head is of men exploiting women, and that is, like, the opposite of my, like, ideology about everything that has to do with sex, that, like, if we have an idea that of fetishes about men exploiting women, we probably don't understand it as well as we could.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I'm so interested to learn more about it. And you were saying that it's really big in the gay male community. Yeah. I also, like...
Yeah, well, so you know, like, the bear community, obviously. Sure. So, I mean, I think just generally it's a body type that has a lot of cachet in the gay male community. I can talk about this stuff online on the shoot too, but I think also the idea of, like, indulging yourself in behavior is, like, something that's really understood in that community more in some ways. And so, it stands to reason, but...
Well, so speaking of gay men and speaking of pigs, when you were talking to me about this idea of hedonism, and I was kind of trying to think about where else this concept had arisen in all the things that I know about sexuality, it did make me start to think about the concept of a pig, which is one of the essays from your series, and also just a subject that has always been really interesting to me, and then lately I have been really enjoying more the idea of what identifying as a pig or being called a pig can give. I'll speak for myself and say what it can give me permission to acknowledge about myself, that I just want to roll around in the things that people find disgusting. That's what it is for me. It's like loving like thinking that mud is the best, and like wanting to be dirty, wanting to just have like zero self-consciousness about body fluids and just opening yourself up to being used and not, you know, the like squeal like a piggy thing. It's like let, you know, how somebody would think that that would be humiliating, and saying like, no, that's not humiliating. That's the thing that I want.
Yeah, I totally get that. Are we...
Oh yeah, okay, yeah, great. we're rolling again. Yeah.
So I totally get that, and I would say it's the other side of the coin though of what I'm into, because even if it's not about humiliation, I think a lot of like piggy play is about submission and pleasure and submission. Mm. And I'm really interested in encouraging somebody from a position where they're in a position of power and I'm in service to them
by encouraging them.
So I wouldn't, like, that term doesn't resonate as much with me because it's not something I would use for someone who was like in this position of power kind of over me, where I was like, oh, you get to do whatever you want because you have all the power and I'm like here to please you in these ways. You were asking about like other scenes that feel erotic to me, and I'll say as a kid also, and you know, still to this day, any scene, there's so many of them, of like the kind of cliche of someone reclining in a chaise and being fed grapes, you know, from the bunch and fanned with like a palm frond, was super hot to me, which is the Bacchanalia. Like, that's the image of Bacchus, right? And the whole idea of Bacchus, like, the myth of Bacchus, this god who is about feasting and wine and being served with pleasure and, like, dancing women and who are, like, totally getting off. It was super hot to me.
And the idea that, and, you know, and then Dionysian, too, is,
the other.
Part of the idea of that is the idea of having a god that you worship, or an archetype, like Bacchus, like Dionysus, that you worship, is that for a specific period of time, you totally go nuts.
Go there, yeah.
And don't have, you know, you like lose control and see and experience that and see what that's like, because you're part of that ritual, because you're part of that celebration, and then when the ritual is over, when the holiday is over, you are able to recognize that then having self-control again is good, and like moderation is good the rest of the time, but you don't feel, in my mind, in my experience, then you don't always feel this like itch from repressing it all the time.
Yeah.
You like let it loose. And then you can go back to sort of an ordinary, sustainable pitch.
Right, which is why, I mean, which I think is so fascinating about our ideas of the Roman Empire, right? That you would have these, you would have a very well-run democracy or whatever, and then you would have these feasts and orgies and rituals that allowed you to, like, go into your deepest animal self,
right.
And then you kind of come back to, you know, running
a good polis. Right?
But that's the fall of the Roman Empire, right? Is that then there was, like, Caligula, and there's, like, Nero, and there's the people who totally got out of control and never got it back to the moderated thing.
They didn't get it.
Right. They didn't have good scene boundaries.
Exactly. No, it's so fascinating to think about the way that power would corrupt somebody like Caligula. Have you seen the Malcolm McDowell?
I have. I mean, I've got a big Malcolm McDowell fetish too, because even in Clockwork Orange, he's got that going on, right?
Sure.
So yeah, I've totally seen Caligula, although it's unfortunately like, it goes a little dark. Like, that's the problem with all these things. Like, I love the beginning of Boogie Nights, too, because I love the, like, hedonism indulgence movie, but then usually it becomes, like, a Lifetime special where it's like, and then they hit bottom.
Oh, my God.
And I'm like, I just want to stop it before they hit bottom. Can we just have the, like, orgy scene?
They have to be punished.
They have to be punished, right.
Well, it's the same with Magic Mike. Have you seen the first Magic Mike?
I turned it off because I was like, I don't like where this is going.
No, you were correct to do so. It really the first part of Magic Mike, I feel like I've said this on the podcast before, the first like hour of that movie, the first time I watched it, I was like, I could watch this weekly, and it's not just like the eye candy of the abs or anything like that. I was
it's
like
a-
the
Sex, it's a positive movie about sex workers, for one thing.
Exactly, you know, and what's his name who plays the werewolf on True Blood, like, at the sewing machine with his gold lamé thong, like, just everything about that, I was like, I could watch this over and over and over again, and then, yeah, and then it does really become like, oh, well, there's no way that you would actually, like, be able to go into this dark underworld, what's behind the curtain without losing control to the point of addiction, which is actually something that you were talking about, where, like, it's about, I guess, to take a step back from Magic Mike or Caligula or Boogie Nights and say, like, this really is a problem in our society that we punish people, you know, in these stories. Yeah, we pathologize and punish people who want to indulge because we're not equipped to teach ourselves and to teach each other common sense about boundaries.
Totally.
And that there's no way of going all out. Like, if you go all out, it's, like, step, like, point one, step one is the point of no return. And that's right. Completely not true.
Oh, yeah, and I have so much to say about this, but, like, so one thing I'll say is that it's sometimes frustrating to me, you know, in the scene or in the community, to meet people who will be beaten until they're black and blue, or, you know, have medical play scenes where they're, like, bleeding like crazy, and really are risking, you know, an ambulance coming or whatever, and everybody's like, yeah, that's so cool that you just did that. And if I talk about, like, so I want to encourage somebody to have another drink, or, like, can we talk about the emotional edge play of what it would mean to be like, oh, honey, you should eat a little bit more high cholesterol food. People are like, well, that's terrifying. You know, like, you just beat each other. So that is fascinating to me. I do think that we have a lot of issues in our culture around that slippery slope idea. And it dovetails for me also with, I have a big problem, you know, as many people do in our community, around this notion of sex addiction. And I was specifically, as we were talking about movies, thinking about, because you were talking about going into the dark underworld, thinking about Shame. Did you see?
Oh my god.
Like, the worst movie ever.
It's a Steve McQueen directed that movie,
yes,
right?
It's so disappointing. So, and I'd read all these things about it beforehand, and I was like, oh, this sounds, you know, it's about sex, whatever, I'll see.
I mean,
it.
Michael Fassbender's full frontal nudity.
Yes.
Yes. You know, we could just watch a gif of that. Sure. And then that would
and
be
there's actually a great scene with sex with an escort in a hotel room in New York City, which is beautiful, or wherever they are. But the whole idea is, like, because he's interested in sexual pleasure,
yeah,
and he's non-monogamous, he's a fucking mess, and he's, like, a psychopath, and that the scene at the end is, like, and you know how he really, like, you know he's really far gone, is because he went to a gay orgy.
I know.
Like.
I know.
How? Like, he must be whacked out of his mind if he wants to have anonymous sex with men, or, like, also that he, so he watches porn, and he hires like, a really responsible, high-class call girl.
Yeah.
So, clearly, the guy is fucked up. Like, what? No! Like, that's normal.
Like, and
that's,
then he starts dating his coworker, who is definitely, he has, like, a position of authority over her. It's been a few years since I've seen it, but that's sort of,
that's fine.
Played, but it's right. Played. That's it's played, played as fine. Sort of like, yeah, like tantamount to everything. Else. But yeah, but no, exactly. That it's kind of like, oh well, this might be the moment where he could be redeemed
healthy.
Because this would be like healthy and normal. But like, actually, that's the thing that shows that he has bad right. boundaries.
Right. Exactly. Totally. And yeah, I mean, that movie's so upsetting to me for so many reasons. But the whole idea that like, if you look, I mean, as you know, I'm sure, as probably maybe many of your listeners know, like, there's nobody in the DSM, like, psychiatric world who will put sex addiction on the books as an actual thing.
Right.
It's highly controversial, and if you go to look at the definitions of sex addiction, where they are, it includes things like thinking frequently about sex and masturbating.
Right.
It's insane. So, I really think that, like, yes, there are people who don't know how to communicate in healthy ways around their sexuality, and there are people who, you know, have a problem figuring out good boundaries, and there are people who But none of that is addiction.
Right.
And none of that is sex addiction. And the idea that somebody would be thinking about sex a lot and finding ways to have consensual, pleasurable sex a lot is not a pathology. In fact, it's what we should all be striving toward.
Right, and the thing that also bugged me about that movie, Shame, is, first of all, the fact that it is called Shame,
right.
Kind of, he's kind of showing his hand,
yep,
with that, and a movie that shows the way that shame cripples people, and that people feel shame for their sexual desire, even if their sexual desire is, like, not for rape, not for anything that would be harmful, truly harmful to themselves or others. Like, a portrait of that would be an extremely fascinating,
sure,
thing to explore, but that's not the movie
that's
that he
movie.
Made. He's, it really feels more like propaganda.
It
almost.
Totally was. It was such sex negative propaganda. And we could have a whole podcast just about movies, but, like, I'll say I just watched The Sleepover.
Oh, The Overnight.
The Overnight.
I haven't seen it, but I have heard about it, right? With Jason Schwartzman and
yes,
Adam Scott. And
Yes. So, yet again, spoiler alert, like, basically the message at the end of the movie. First of all, from the very get-go, it was like, they're setting this up to be a movie in which they go over to their friend's house, like, these new friends' house, and maybe the friends are going to proposition them for swinging or, like,
right,
swapping. And I was like, the movie's going to say more than that, right? Because that can't be that interesting to people. Like, that can't be, like, the whole crisis of the movie. But, in fact, it is.
Right.
What if your really hot, attractive, friendly, cool neighbors said, hey, want to have some consensual group sex with us?
And that's the, like,
that's mind-blowing.
That's, like, the thing that we're, that
the
critics are not talking about when they're, like, and then something happens, and I'm, like, is it something more than
No, it's the thing that the movie sets you up for from the beginning, which also just, I mean, in my world, it's not that big of a deal, really. And, but then at the end, what is the spoiler is, like, the couple who have been exploring non-monogamy or are interested and open to it, come back to the protagonist couple who were like, no, and they're like, oh, don't worry, we're in therapy now.
Oh.
And the, like, no couple who have been shown to have, like, a pretty fucked up relation, like, marriage, and that hasn't been going that well.
Yeah.
They're all like, oh, we said no to the swingers, so, like, look how good and happy we are. And now the, like, potential swinger couple has come to us, and who also make porn, by the way, like, really cool fetish porn in the movie, and the wife does some sex work. They came, and they're like, oh, we're in therapy now. And they're like, good. It's so upsetting. And I was like, this is even, like, what the indies are making. Like, this is, it's so upsetting. Anyway.
I'm with you 100%. And I think that it is important to talk about movies because these are our dreams. These are the stories that we are telling each other, and they say everything about what we think, and they say everything about what, I mean, I think movies control us, and I don't necessarily think it's, like, an insidious thing. Like, there is a department of the government that is like, we need to make sure that we suppress swinging, so we're gonna make this movie that is an allegory for fear and shame. But I think it's so ingrained in people that, you know, they might have their own shame about their own desires, and so then they're like, I'm gonna make this story in which people say no to the scary sexual indulgence thing, and then come out on top. So it's like their own,
their own
fantasy.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's sort of like, to kind of bring us back to, like, hedonism a little, I feel like it's the same as how Hollywood movies still punish, the body that does not conform to our standards of attractiveness. And so if there's a character who's heavy, they have to, like, lose weight and have a makeover in order to be, like, suddenly be attractive at the end or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, so that's, like, also upsetting to me. And that just gets played out over and over, and
or, like, eat shit and die.
Right, totally.
Sometimes.
Right,
yeah.
And I was even seeing this, I don't want to talk about media the whole time, but, like, in Amy Schumer recently, I love Amy Schumer in so many ways, but I am noticing that, like, some of her stuff around her body, which, you know, I think a lot of it is really brave and interesting and feminist, but she is, in a way, also saying, like, it's fucked up that the culture thinks I'm fat.
Yeah.
Because I'm actually not fat, but if I was... like, that would be a problem. Or even, like,
or, like,
making fun of herself for being somebody who eats food. Or kind of, like, calling attention to the ways in which her body is imperfect. And in her HBO special, she did a lot of that. And at other times, she'd sort of talk about, like, she'd joke, right? Like, oh, I'm so beautiful. Like, you all love me so much. And the audience would go crazy. Mm. Because the truth is... they do love her so much, exactly the way she is. They do think she's super hot, exactly the way she is. She's super hot. They don't want her to lose weight.
Mm.
Like, and she's kind of like, yeah, I'm not going to lose weight because I'm, like, a feminine, you know, whatever. But I'm like, yeah, but other people don't want you to lose weight because, like, they think you look totally good.
Right.
So that's another, you know, kind of challenge for me and way that it, feels taboo. Like, what I like and have always liked feels really taboo is, you know, I'd say for me, like, 50% of it is the psychology of somebody indulging themselves in the things that they most want to experience that are pleasurable for them, and the other 50% is the physical evidence of that. So I like when somebody actually acts a little drunk. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not enough for them to have just drank. Like, they have to kind of, I don't want them shit-faced from falling on the ground, but I want them to be, like, a little, like, oh, I'm having a good time. And I definitely like the physical evidence of having eaten a little too much, too. Like, that is the body type I'm most attracted to. It has been that way since I was a little kid, too. Like, which is really hard to explain or talk about in regular society, to say, you know, if somebody says, like, oh, you know, that guy used to be really cute, but he's gained 20 pounds. And for me to be like, yeah, totally like him better now. Or, you know, whatever it is. So
you like the evidence of people having indulged, even if you are not the person who... encourage them to do so.
I would say, actually, like, for me, the it has to originate with them. They have to want it bad.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
For themselves, and then I'm kind of like a catalyst,
and they're like at the point where they're like, maybe not, and that's right. Where you come in,
or even like they've already started and I'm like, yeah, keep going with that. So
that's
it's a really big thing in the gay gainer community, which is huge, to have, like, there's like a phrase which is totally my thing too, which is the, like, well-fed, like, the ex-jock look. Right, so you want the evidence that the guy does take care of himself, is physically healthy, does have some kind of, like, sense of, you know, not going down, like, not going to a place of just, some people are really into people who are, like, completely immobilized and not well, but there are a lot of people, especially, I'd say, gay guys, who are really into the look of, like, you totally used to be on the football team, but now you're not, and you have, like, the little belly, like, the nice, round, tight belly to prove it. And that's my jam.
Is that kind of what they mean when they talk about the dad bod? It's a kind of dad bod.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, it, you know, there's a huge thing in the tabloids, too, about that, right? Like,
about
the
dad bod,
the ripped honk, Hollywood honk, who's, like, let his body go a little bit. Or the, like, hottie woman who's, like, in the bikini, but now you can see she's had a kid, or, like, she's not in perfect shape anymore. I love those pictures, because I'm like, oh, yeah, you had a good time on that vacation.
Yeah.
You ate and drank what you wanted to. Like, that's hotter. That's so much hotter to me than, like, you've just been at the gym.
I do really love the idea that your fetish is kind of about defying repression.
Yeah.
or like Puritanism.
Mm-hmm.
But it manifests in these two very specific ways of eating and drinking.
Yeah, it does. But I would say it's about all of that. Like, I think it's about, really, it's about, like, sex positivity. It's about generally letting yourself be into what you're into and, like, aroused by what you're aroused by or whatever. So it is also really hot to me to hear somebody say, you know, I think those people over there are super sexy and I want to fuck them.
Right, right. So
admission of that kind of desire. It's admission of desire, really, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Total admission of hedonistic desire in the face of societal repression. Yeah.
So what I want to do is go through the seven deadly sins, and
I can masturbate to definitions of the seven deadly sins as a kid too. Yeah,
awesome. What about the movie Seven?
No,
that's like about punishment, and not good punishment. But the movie Seven is the only reason that I can remember what the seven deadly sins are. So we've kind of got the fetish manifestation of gluttony.
Absolutely.
And the fetish manifestation of lust in this infrastructure that we're talking about is really kind of about, it might for other people, manifest as cuckolding, right? So when, like, a couple are both turned on by the idea of one or the other couple sleeping with someone else and kind of, like, to some degree or another, rubbing their face
lording
in, or yeah, maybe humiliating them, but also just, yeah, lording it over them, exactly.
Yeah.
But then that might also be, it might also manifest in something that is maybe not quite that, like, triangulated humiliation.
No.
It might just kind of be like swinging, we were talking about with Cooper Beckett last episode, about, like, enjoying, like, giving your partner permission to fuck this other person.
And it's also about just naked desire in that way. So another cartoon that I loved as a kid, thanks to cartoons, right, is all the Tex Avery cartoons where the wolf is watching the burlesque showgirl and his tongue falls on the floor and
his eyes start beating. And steam comes out of his ears.
That was so hot to me because I was like, oh, he is out of control with lust. So just manifestations of being out of control with lust for somebody else, like whether or not you even act on it or you encourage someone to do it, is also hot.
So it's not necessarily for you about being the object of that lust. It's just about witnessing it.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. So that's lust. And then, so one that we were talking about also, it would be greed, and obviously being a greedy little piggy or a greedy little slut who's greedy for a cock or greedy for orgasms and just can't get enough orgasms is, I think a lot of people can probably wrap their minds around that. But another thing that it makes me think of is financial domination.
Yeah.
Where part of what the idea of financial domination is, in a way, encouraging someone to spend extravagantly. The point of financial domination is for them to be spending extravagantly on you, on the top, on the dominant, on the enabler or encourager. I don't know that much about financial domination where someone's like, I want you to spend extravagantly on something that doesn't financially benefit me. Maybe that exists, but it's more like, take me out to this really fancy dinner, take me shopping at the fanciest places and buy me whatever I want, or just straight up give me your credit card information. I want you to give me $500 cash right now. You're not even worthy of knowing why. Just give it to me for nothing.
So I do both of those from the bottom perspective, right? So as a service sub, more like that's my psychology. I'm more into, for the first part of it, like saying, you're so, do you want me to keep sucking your cock? You do? Oh, like, you're so greedy. I've been sucking your cock for an hour. Like, that kind of thing. Like, I'm in service to his pleasure, but I'm kind of like playing with that idea that he's being greedy and I'm encouraging that. And similarly, like, I do enjoy a sort of like sugar daddy, like being the beneficiary of that, of sort of being like, you're going to spend money extravagantly on me. I'm not asking you to do it. You're doing it because you want to do it. And if that's maybe not the best financial decision for you, but I'm just going to go with it, right? Or being like, yeah, totally, you should get that for me. Again, like, just so like in the real world application of this right now, we're not in the financial, or I would say my partner, my primary partner, is not in the financial position to do that. So we talk about it a lot, but we don't actually play with that yet.
Interesting.
But his financial situation is going to change soon. And we talk a lot about, like, I will text him and just be like, can't wait for the sugar daddy thing. Can't wait. Like, can't, I'm so excited. But it's like a year out. And, yeah, I mean, sort of similarly with all of that stuff, like, we do, there are lines that we don't cross if it would genuinely be not pleasurable, because there'd be real life repercussion. But so, and one of the other Seven Deadly Sins is vice, and I would say all of this stuff is kind of like vice. Oh,
wait, which one is vice?
Vice is a, is one of, it's just like called vice, right?
I can't remember. I mean, vice is sort of like, just like a general term for sin. I'm trying to think of what is that, like, avarice?
It's avarice, maybe. As
is that, does that mean,
I mean, I have to, we'll have to look up the seven deadly sins.
I can't remember what it is in the movie.
Yeah, I don't remember the movie that well, but I would say, like, when I first, I can tell you also about, like, how I came to find this partner, because it's related to all of this stuff, but the fact that he gambled was really hot to me. Gambling makes me personally want to throw up. Like, it's so nerve-wracking to me. It's terrifying. I don't get any pleasure from it myself, but somebody else doing it, again, like, if he really seemed like a gambling addict, which I do think is a real thing, then that would be scary. But the fact that he just kind of liked it, and the whole culture around it was really hot to me. We were at an event recently that had a cigar and, you know, boot blacking night.
One of my favorites.
Yep. And he, you know, actual smoking cigarettes, again, terrifies me. Also, I don't really like anything about it at all. But if he smokes a cigar, like, I'm basically down on my knees in 2 seconds flat, like a puddle. Like, I'm just like, ah! It's so exciting to me. And I think it's kind of like crazy to me, actually, what a response it generates for me, and I think it's because I am so opposed to cigarette smoking. Like, I really think it's yucky. I really think it's wrong. I want nothing to do with it. And so cigars come, like, right up to the edge of that. And for me to be like, oh my God, you're smoking a cigar. and it really is, like, again, you know, it's a hardwired thing for me. I have no control over it. My body responds before my mind does. I see him smoking a cigar, and, like, my whole body is just like, oh, crazy.
Yeah, part of what I like about this fetish is that it is sort of a meta fetish of a lot of different, maybe seemingly unrelated, like, I know a lot of people who are cigar fetishists and have collections and have lots of gear and will, you know, do objectification play where someone is somebody's mouth is an ashtray, and I find all of that stuff really interesting. I like cigars, and I find them really fun and sexy, and part of what is fun and sexy about them is that it takes a long time to smoke one, and while that's happening, the rest of the world melts away, and that is,
and it's
like the
ritual,
definition of
right?
sex. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. It's leisurely. I mean, people smoke cigarettes kind of frantically, you know, on a street corner over a garbage can. Like, that's not hot. I mean, that is hot to some people I know. It's not hot to me, but the whole, like the gesture of a cigar is so leisurely and powerful too. Like, again, as a kind of like service sub in all of this psychology, to see somebody standing over me holding a cigar. I mean, it's so Tony Soprano too, right?
Absolutely.
It's like, oh God, like, you are so powerful right now.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it is an indulgence, and it's just, it's almost, it's hammy. And, and campy.
Totally.
And a lot of this stuff that I'm hearing from you is also kind of about
theatrics.
I mean, it makes me also think about some of my taste in, again, going back to movies, but, like, a lot of my taste in culture is for things that are just, like, really, like, smack you in the face, And it is fun to indulge in those things. But specifically what you're talking about is not even the fun of indulging in them, but the power exchange with somebody else to do so.
Yeah.
Gambling is an interesting one to me, too, because I've never liked gambling. Part of that is my grandparents lived in Vegas, so I kind of grew up around it, and I was like...
Yeah, it's icky.
No. But also, I feel like I can understand and empathize with most, the appeal of most things, even if it's, like, not for me.
Right.
And I don't understand gambling, and in that way, it's interesting to me. Anytime I can't figure something out, I'm like, what? It's so abstract. I also don't really like games, but we can, in general. So I guess it's kind of like the ultimate game.
Yeah.
But it's like a void. Like gambling is like, there's nothing there.
Right.
So I guess in a way it's, maybe what people like about it is that just like the sheer human invention that people are agreeing to do something that is completely meaningless, and then the stakes become...
Right. Well, it's risky behavior. It's a kind of risky behavior, which is the only thing about it that is sort of hot to me. But yeah,
if you're gonna be, there's so many risky things to do that have
more payoff.
And anyway. So, yeah. but no, that's interesting that. So is it hot to you to imagine like hovering over somebody's shoulder while they're like sitting at a blackjack table and being like, yeah, just do, you know. Just put another chip on the... I don't know anything about gambling.
Me neither. So at the last event we attended, there was a, like, kinky casino event that Stefanos put on.
That sounds right, yeah.
Yeah, so they were looking for kind of people to staff it, and so they were looking for dealers, and my partner volunteered to be a blackjack dealer, which was itself hot to me, and I volunteered to be a cocktail waitress, and so I got all dressed up. And my job, it was, like, literally my job was to serve drinks and, you know, come around to the tables to people who were gambling and, like, ask them if they wanted a drink and get them one from the bar. And I could be flirty about it, but there was nothing, like, it was just really that was my job. And somebody else told me to do it, so it was, like, my task, and I wanted to do it well, and I am that kind of service sub. It was really one of the hottest things that I did at the event. I did a lot of hot things at that event. But I really went to, like, a kind of subspace with it. Where I was, like, teetering around on my heels, fetching drinks, asking people. You know, in my regular life, as is true for many subs, I am a totally powerful, opinionated, responsible, you know, woman with a ton of agency.
Right.
So my sub, you know, space is, like, the flip side of my real life.
Absolutely.
And it really, let me go deep into that mindset. Like, I was a Playboy Club bunny, which is one of my big fantasies. I was just, like, cute and flirty and asking people if they wanted drinks and bringing them drinks while they gambled. I was, like, in heaven.
Well, the social stratification of a place like that is so... well drawn.
Yes. And I was being objectified. Like, they were like, oh, come here, honey. Like, I need another drink. Like, you look really cute. Let me turn around. I was like, oh, God, I love this so much. And I was doing a good job, like, helping them indulge their own pleasures, including me and my appearance, which is also really hot to me, like, being objectified in that way.
And everybody in that, because it's a kink space, everybody there is... entering into it, agreeing that that is going to be the dynamic between everyone, and obviously there is the opportunity to say,
"Yeah,
you're actually going too far and objectifying me too much."
Right? They were super respectful.
So everybody is kind of playing in that.
They're playing the same game. Yeah, it was awesome. Like, I served drinks to Lolita Wolf. Like, he was like, "I like your outfit." I was like, "Oh,
yeah." she loves that.
Yeah, it was totally great. And I would say something that's sort of come to me recently is I'm practicing with a new burlesque troupe that's starting up in my area.
Cool.
And I've kind of, like, had this epiphany recently where I was like, oh, this is what I've wanted my whole life. Like, ever since I was a kid, like, I totally had fantasies of working in a strip club, you know, when I was, like, I thought about it.
you know, and but I was like such a good girl and a feminist, and I was like, unless I can strip with the lusty lady, I don't want to strip. Like, I know that I'm not gonna actually like that. Like, let's be honest about this. And I was like, and I want the theatrics, and I want, like, a pretty costume, and I want it to be to a good song. Like, I don't want it to be, like, bad techno music, you know? So now that I'm sort of starting to practice with this burlesque group, I was like, oh, I've wanted to do burlesque my whole life, because you're right in this theatrical space where everyone's totally respectful and encouraging and nice, and, like, no one's going to touch you in a way that you don't want to be touched, and you get to dress, wear whatever you want, and it's a show.
Right.
You have this sort of distance, and I was like, but you get to take all your clothes off if you want to, or, like, almost all your clothes off.
Right.
And be appreciated. I was like, oh, yeah, like, this this makes sense to me. Yeah, so anyway, that was, that, like, that whole, the gambling, the casino environment was, like, really fantastic for me in a lot of ways. And I do think it's about how exotic that is to me, because it's not what I want for myself. I would get no pleasure from sitting at a gambling table. I don't even get it. I actually don't even like to drink particularly. Like, I'll have a drink if it tastes good. I've never been drunk in my life. My body seems to metabolize alcohol in a way where I don't get drunk. But also, I've never really tried. But you'd think for somebody...
I was
going to
say, you could keep trying.
I could keep trying. But you'd think for somebody who rarely drinks that if I did have a few drinks, I'd get drunk. But the times that I have, I feel a momentary physical response where I'm like, I'm a little unsteady on my feet. Nothing happens to me mentally, and it passes in 5 minutes.
Wow.
It's weird. So like, that part, I don't even, like, get what it's like to be drunk in the world. And I don't have a desire to drink a lot. I don't like the feeling of having eaten too much. It's not pleasurable for me. So in some ways, I think a lot of this is about, like, how foreign it is, like, how othered it is to think about the pleasure of getting off on these things. I'm a type A, hyper-responsible, anxious person. So any kind of overdoing it actually causes me a great deal of stress.
Right. So you're, in a way, kind of projecting that, and you can, like, safely indulge in the fantasy of everyday indulgence by projecting it consensually onto someone else.
Right, and by watching somebody else really do it for their own sake. Yeah.
Right. That's the key part. Okay, so there's jealousy, but jealousy doesn't seem like as fun of a one to indulge in.
So we sort of play with that, I would say, in the kind of, like, I love it if my partner comes back from having played with somebody else, and I'm like, you know, I've been sitting home alone or whatever. I've been at the event by myself for a couple hours because they're off fucking somebody else.
Yeah.
And then they come back and I'm like, yeah, let's mess around while you tell me what a good time you had with somebody else.
There it is.
Yeah. Which isn't the same as cuckolding, because I don't want to be humiliated about it.
Right.
But I just want to hear, like, you had a really good time with some other, like, really hot person. Wow, like, that's also a kind of emotional edge play. Like, there is a little part of me that's like, hey, but that's like 2%. 98% is like, oh my god, that's so high. Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, that checks out. Rage?
I mean, I guess in the sense that I like some good dominant energy coming toward me. I like rough sex a lot.
Right.
I like being pinned down. I like being thrown up against a wall.
Yeah.
I like being smacked across the face sometimes. So that sense of being a little testosterone-y out of control is super hot to me, too.
Oh, you're so smart. I was like, what? But rage. No, but no, you're totally right, because as somebody who also enjoys that, as a switch, too, like, I enjoy both sides of it, but as, a bottom in a rough sex scenario, what is hot about it is the sense that you know that that is a desire that someone has, and you are saying, it's okay.
Do it.
Do it.
Yeah.
I want it.
It's about carnal appetites, right?
It is about carnal appetites.
I would say, like, another thing that sometimes I call myself or I identify with is the primal sex community. Because, yeah, if I really feel like if he's growling, or if she's, like, biting me because they, like, can't take how much they want it and they're right. like getting a little violent, that's super hot. Like, it's lust and it's also that kind of like edge of violence. That's
right, you're like stripping away civilization.
Totally.
Stripping away society. And also, like, why do we not indulge in these things? Why do we not grab our lover and shove her against the wall? Why do we not have another donut? Why do we not have another glass of wine? Why do we not fuck the like whoever we see when we're walking down the street? Because perhaps reasonably we yeah. understand that there will be consequences.
Yes.
So in a way, your fetish is not removing the consequence, but removing the worry about the consequence.
Yeah, or temporarily removing the consequence.
Like,
or kind of, like, maintaining a space where the consequences are mitigated, right?
Right,
so, I mean,
right.
you know, this stuff, it can be really hard to scene with. Like, I don't do a lot of pickup play because it's so much about the psychology of it.
Right.
Although I'm not opposed to that. I'm really open to it if it, like, comes along. But, but I would say, like, in my, you know, my primary sexual relationship, it's a 24/7 power exchange dynamic. And it's really about kind of, like, telling him, like, encouraging him to drink as much as he wants. And then when he gets to the point where I'm, like, where it's clear that he's, like, if he's going to have another drink, it's not going to be good.
Right.
And he's not going to feel good. I'm, like, okay, now we go home, and here's a bottle of water. You know, like, I don't want you to feel like shit in the morning. I want you to feel really good, because that's the fun part, right? Like, that's right. the part where we can really play with it.
Well, there's so much trust in that relationship.
Yeah.
Where he
yeah.
can let go because he knows that you're gonna take care of him. It's really yeah. quite romantic.
And I make raw kale salads and, like, make him drink, you know, beet juice and stuff like that. He never, I mean, he used to be, before we were together, he genuinely indulged in some unhealthy behavior, which was not good for him, you know, right. sexually and food and drink.
Yeah.
And so a big part of our dynamic is about, like, how can he do these things in ways that are consensual with his partner and
sustainable
and also, like, super erotic to both of us and not stressful. You know, like, he was in a relationship where he did have sex with other people, but it was cheating.
Right.
And that felt like shitty. That felt shitty to everybody, including him. I mean,
right.
when he came home, he didn't feel good about himself,
right.
obviously. He wasn't, like, high on the fact that he cheated. He
right.
needed to have sex with somebody, and that wasn't happening in his relationship, so sure. But, you know, I have empathy for that, but it wasn't like, a good thing all around. So I think it's really hot for him, too, for me to be like, I totally want you to go fuck somebody else and come back and tell me about it. And I want you, you know, as we walk down the street, I want you to tell me every time you see someone's ass that you like.
Yeah.
I want to hear about it. Yeah.
Is there any other, like, major note that you want to make sure that we hit before we...
I want to hear your questions, but I was just thinking about, I can, if you want, tell, like, just the brief story of, like, how I came to find my partner and how it's related to this. And, like, that I think part of it, too, is about how I was always really, like, as a feminist, like, attracted to people who, you know, that I think it's even more exotic to me to be with somebody who sort of has these, like, big appetites and bad behaviors, because I mostly steered clear of that as a feminist.
Right.
Like, I didn't want a partner who just, like, drank too much, like, ate a lot of meat and, like, watched sports, because I was like, but to find somebody who had that and, like, this other side, you know, where they totally got who I am,
yeah,
and had the same kind of politics was like, oh, cool. Now we can play, you know, anyway.
Cool, yeah. Well, let's definitely talk about that. Okay. Lust, greed, rage, envy. Do we talk about pride?
We didn't talk about pride.
Can you think of a fantasy or manifestation of pride?
We did, in a way, because one of the things I said about the Templeton scene is that he's so proud of himself, right?
Right.
So that is definitely part of it. Like, there, again, in the gaynor community, there are a lot of people who, for whom somebody's saying, like, being humiliated or ashamed of how much they just ate is a big part of it. Like, they want the person to be like, I didn't do that bad thing, or like, I did and I feel horrible about it, or whatever. But for me, I really want somebody who's like, yeah, I did that. Yeah, yeah, I smoked that cigar. Yeah, I like ate that donut, whatever it is. And just being like,
Yeah, I fucked you.
Totally.
You sucked my dick.
That's right. I love that.
Or even, actually, another thing that's coming to mind is also worship. Mm-hmm. Like, telling someone that they are beautiful, telling someone that they look beautiful, telling someone that a certain part of their body is so sexy.
Yes.
And to the degree that worship is a service.
Totally. So I totally do that. I completely do a lot of, like, body worship, specifically a lot of belly worship and cock worship too.
They're right next to each other. So.
Sometimes I wonder about that in terms of, like, because, you know, one of the theories around the way our brains work, for those of us who are hardwired fetishists, is that literally, like, some wires crossed, like, some synapses. And, you know, some people theorize that, like, foot fetishists are foot fetishists because, like, well, if you just travel up the leg a little bit, like, there's all your junk.
Right.
And so I sometimes wonder about that with the belly. I'm like, it's so close, you know? Like, to all the other good things.
I mean, a foot is also a phallus.
Yes, right.
And a belly is kind of, I mean, it's like, in terms of the curve of it, like, a nice belly is like a nice ass or a nice pair of tits. Oof. Just like something that you just want to touch and manipulate and put your face up against.
Oh my god, yeah. And it's power to me too, right? In a lot of cultures, like, the rich, powerful people were the people with bellies because they had enough money to eat and feed themselves.
Right.
It's also pregnant women, like mother, like earth mother kind of thing. So for all those reasons, I think bellies can really convey fertility and power
taking up space,
indulgence, and all that kind of good stuff, for sure. And then also, I would say on the other side of pride is, like, I like the kind of arm candy role, right? Like, he tells me, if I walk, you know, if I go to the bathroom or at a restaurant and, like, walk back, and he watches me walk back, and he's like, you know, other people were turning around to look at you when you walked back to the table. I'm so proud of how you look tonight. Like, that's really hot to me, too.
Cool.
Yeah. Like, being an object that he's proud of owning.
So we did lust. I haven't said lust yet, right?
We said we did lust.
But in this list, right, now okay. I've lost track of my list. And then...
I feel like I need to look up the Seven Deadly Sins. Do you think that's
fun? Oh god, now I have to do it again. Okay. Okay. And I straight up am thinking of the gruesome murders of...
No, it's great.
I love that movie. That's... I mean, speaking of over-the-top things that are fun to indulge in, that kind of psychological horror is, like, exactly that for me.
It was good.
Okay. Gluttony, pride, greed, lust, rage, envy...
Yep, okay, here we go. Where is it? Lust, gluttony, greed, sloth. Oh my
sloth.
God. Totally.
Oh. So just stay in bed, babe.
Oh my god, oversleeping is really hot to me.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Me too, babe.
But, like, I don't do it. I hate oversleeping.
That makes complete sense in the type A. Yeah.
I feel like I've missed something. I feel, like, horrible about myself. Unless we stay out till 3 a.m, it's really hard for me to stay in bed past 9, you know, ever. And usually I'm out by 7. And the fact that he sometimes wants to sleep till noon, I'm like... Oh yeah, you stay there.
So you're also, this is another example of you sort of living vicariously through the person that you're encouraging to indulge.
Right, yeah, I mean, I guess so. I mean, really for myself, I don't want to do it, but I think it's really hot that he does, right? So, or even I would say, you know, the kind of body worship that we're talking about involves a level, like, he just lies there.
Right. and that goes back to your fantasy of the feeding someone grapes and bonbons and then like Cleopatra,
yes,
emperor, yes, empress,
being
monarch.
Served in that way. Like you're just passively lying back and letting yourself be pleasured. Well, and you're not doing anything. Like, you're not lifting a finger.
Yeah.
That's really hot to me, for sure.
Okay, I think we nailed all of
them. All 7 deadly sins. Turns out that's my fetish. So now we have a name for it. I'm so relieved.
I want to sort of create more of a taxonomy of it, because I feel like there's so many things that you've said that resonate with me and make me think of people that I know. And think that maybe people don't quite know how to talk about it yet.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And can we make a
something
porn
new
series
under
on
the sun.
7 deadly sins that really gets
you know,
into the fetish stuff?
James Dean.
I've heard about this.
Did it. I haven't watched them at
but
all.
But I feel like, so when I've seen, I haven't watched them all either, and I did hear about that, but I feel like when mainstream kind of porn does that sort of thing, like if they do gluttony, they're going to do like, I'm licking chocolate off your body.
Right.
Like they're not going to actually do overindulgence in quite that way, right? So yeah, I want the super kink version where they really go for it.
And it would be great to have a framing device of a figure like you who is in setting up these scenarios, because then they just want to like lay back and watch.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah,
well, we just, whoever wants to finance this, yes, just let us know. It's in development. Yeah. So something that I wanted to bring up is, do you listen to the Savage Lovecast?
Not so much, a little bit. Okay. I definitely know, like, one thing I'll say is actually he got a letter from a female feeder, you know, early on, like obviously before the podcast. And it was one of the only straight, or you know, I'm not straight, but female feeders who was talking about men that I'd ever seen in the media. There's hardly any.
Yeah.
There's an amazing queer writer named Sarah Galvin, who's out in Seattle now, who is a female feeder. And she writes about it beautifully, but she's totally queer. So I was so excited to see this letter, and Dan Savage was like, this is a hoax. He literally said,
wow,
you're not real. This doesn't exist. And
how long
I don't,
ago was that?
It was a long time ago, but
I feel like he doesn't say things like that anymore.
Known better. And that really was like kind of, you know, there's a few reasons why Dan Savage is a little problematic for me, but anyway, he's done great work. But that was really like, hey, really?
Because now I feel like what he always says is like, I've been doing this for 20 years, and if you can think about it, somebody is into it. But but anyway, there was a call, one of the most interesting calls that I've heard on there in a long time, was this woman who called in to say that she was really into being a bad wife. And it was funny because the way the call was, some of the calls are obviously like masturbation sessions for people, like not like they're literally, I'm sure they get a lot of wankers, but not that they're necessarily wanking, but that somebody who, and this is something as a sex worker I'm very familiar with, that sometimes the excitement of just anonymously, or so you think, sharing
airing
your dirty laundry, is you can just hear it in people's voices. But so, and she also just kept using her buzzword. It was so obvious that, you know, she was like, I'm a bad wife. I really like going on spending sprees and charging things to the credit card that we can't afford. And I really like drunk driving. Like, she'll go out to the bar and have too many drinks and then drive home. And she, I can't remember if she said that she actually cheated, but she liked thinking about cheating and all of these things. And it was such a fascinating call, because it was somebody who wasn't like you have sort of recognized this interest and found outlets for it. I'm sure that there have been, you know, there's been a long, like, learning curve of figuring out, like, how to indulge your indulgence fetish.
Right, yes.
But this woman was at a point of, in a way, deep self-awareness.
Yep.
And at the same time, complete self-delusion and I can't even remember what his advice was, but, you know, when I was listening to it, I'm always thinking, like, what would I say to someone if they were, if this person was coming to me? And, really, just like so many other things, it's like polyamory and cheating. It's like, people think that the only way that they can indulge this fantasy or indulge this desire is to be deceptive and to exploit someone, to do it unconsensually. And this woman clearly was not aware of the fact that if she had the opportunity to... that she does have the opportunity to turn to her partner and say, I would really like to play this game.
Yeah.
Let's play this game and let's talk about the stakes and let's talk about what is too much. But instead, she just, like, is... caught up in this, you know, in my opinion, like, not very healthy cycle, and doing things that are, you know, it's one thing to, like, turn to the credit card too much, but she's endangering herself and others by drunk driving, for example, right? Whereas there might be an outlet for that same impulse that would not be as directly dangerous to herself and others.
And there's even, like, the thing called hot wife. Which I could totally, you know, like, that's a whole fetish and a role. And so you could, like, take your wife to the bar and not drink yourself, and she could get totally wasted and fuck some stranger in the bathroom.
Right.
And take Or just flirt with everybody all over the place.
Right, yeah,
whatever. Yeah. And you could just be sitting there and, like, drive her home safely afterwards and just be like, you are such a bad girl.
Yeah.
That could totally work.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, but I would say, you know... And part of why this gets into, like, interesting emotional edge play territory for me is because it sounds also like maybe part of what's hot to her is the deception.
Which it sounded like she maybe... I think she talked about being in a very strict Christian community, and so it sounded to me like this was, like, her psyche finding this way of having agency and asserting herself and having control.
Yeah, so that's genuinely, like, really messy, problematic stuff that can't... that could potentially be translated into, like, a healthy kink dynamic, but isn't there yet, for sure.
No,
yeah. And I would say that, like, when I watch depictions of, like, genuinely out-of-control behavior, like, we watched Big Love, and when, you know, the Nikki character has a spending problem. She really does have a spending problem, and those scenes make me, like, worse than watching a serial killer thing or anything. Like, if I watch somebody, you know, on Home Shopping Network, like, running up their credit cards in a way that they can't afford and they've got, like, kids at home, I'm just like, I have to turn it off. It's, like, so anxiety-producing for me. So there definitely is something about the fact that it does alarm me to such an extent to see people... you know, genuinely addictive behavior is alarming to me.
Right.
Genuinely codependent behavior is really alarming to me. All of that stuff. So being able to come, like, right up to the edge of that, I think, is what feels so, like, sticky and exciting about it.
So how did you come to sort of feel, like, secure and fully realized in this identity and this fetish?
I mean... part of it is really, I would say that, like, because it's been with me for so long, and I just, for whatever reasons, was a really, like, sexually self-aware kid. Like, I knew that I had these things, I knew how to explore them, you know, even from the time I was in middle school, I would say I was, like, seeking out the things that would work for me as erotica, which were not everybody else's erotica because I was a fetishist. So there's actually, like, a scene in A Tree Grows in Brooklyn where the dad is actually an alcoholic, and he's trying to go cold turkey, and he's, like, locked in a room. Like, his wife locks him in a room, like, to, and doesn't, you know, and says, like, you have to just, get, you know.
Get clean.
And he's having a horrible time of it because he's really drunk. And her sister, who is also described as this, like, really hot, kind of slutty
neighborhood, like, chump girl,
and, like, really voluptuous with great boobs and everything, like, slips into the room with a flask between her boobs, like, so hot, and is kind of, like, just weaning, like, helping wean him off. And she is trying to help him get clean, but she's also, like, knows that it would be better to do that more, like, gradually.
That's fascinating.
And that scene, I was like,
that's a fascinating example.
Got off to that scene. So, anyway, I would say, like, from the time I was very, very young, I was already kind of, like, processing this and kind of trying to figure it out and thinking about why, too, like, really trying to think about the psychology of it. And by the time I was, you know, 18 or 19 years old, and the internet happened, because that happened, like, right around that time, so, you know, Usenet and alt.sex and things like that, I was like, and, you know, I'm an academic, and I am by nature a researcher, so right. I kind of knew how to do my research. I really did a lot of homework. But I didn't have an outlet for it in real life until... I met my partner originally in my 20s, and then, you know, which was a brief kind of relationship, and then haven't really gotten to explore it so deeply in action until we got back together 3 years ago. So my whole life, it's like been in my head, which I know is another thing a lot of like hardwired fetishists talk about. Like, they are obsessed with spanking, but they have never had, like, maybe they never will even have a partner they can spank, but it never leaves them. Like, it's just with you all the time.
Yeah.
But like, what an amazing relief, and like how much deeper you can go if you have a partner who, you know, is a good match for you in these ways, and who gets it, and who goes there with you.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's good advice for anyone.
Yeah.
I want to just keep going deeper and deeper and talking about movies and everything all day, but I want you to enjoy your day in New York. So so let's put a pin in it. But and we talked about your... all your shameless plugging, where people can find you. Is there anything else that you felt like we didn't talk about that you wanted to make sure that you...
No, you put I'm out really, there? You know, and as soon as I saw your podcast come into existence, the question, why are people into that? Like, that is my question, you know, like, that's my, that's my thing. Like, I just want to know why everybody is into all their things, because I think for my whole life, I've been thinking about why am I into these things that I'm into.
Right.
So I was just so, I've been so excited to listen to every single episode and so excited to be on the show. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh my God. Thank you for having me. And thank you for having me on your series. And I can't wait to read it for a year.
Yeah. Your essay is going to kick ass. November, so exciting.
Yeah, actually the timing really works out that my essay is going to come out on your series in November, and your episode, I'm pretty sure, is going to come out on the show in November, so.
Perfect.
Fantastic. Well, it's really nice to meet you. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to episode 31. Follow at Tina Horn's Ass and at Into That Podcast on Twitter. Subscribe and write us a review if you would be so kind on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever you listen to podcasts. And visit whyarepeopleintothat.com to subscribe to our newsletter and listen to our entire archive, which is almost 2 years old. As always, Why Are People Into That is produced and hosted by yours truly, Tina Horn. Our theme song is by Pine from Oakland, California. Our website was designed by Justin Levesque, and we are exclusively sponsored by Smitten Kitten. Until next time, I'll be doing everything in moderation, including moderation.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing.
Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.